Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Jill Robbins, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Koalas were declared endangered Friday in eastern Australia. More koalas are dying from disease, lost habitat, and other threats. Earlier, koalas had been considered a vulnerable species. Federal Environment Minister Susan Lee lowered their conservation status on the country's east coast in Queensland, New South Wales, and the Australian Capital Territory. The government's Threatened Species Scientific Committee recommended the change. Many koalas in Australia suffer from chlamydia. The disease causes blindness, infections, and infertility. Last year, the Australian Koala Foundation said the country has lost about 30% of its koalas in the past 3 years. In 2020, a parliamentary investigation warned the species might become extinct before 2050 without immediate help. The number of koalas in Queensland has fallen by half since 2001 because of lack of water, fires, and deforestation. Some are killed in attacks by dogs or hit by cars. Koalas have gone from no listing to vulnerable to endangered within a decade. That is a shockingly fast decline, said Stuart Blanche. He is a conservation scientist with the World Wildlife Fund, Australia. Blanche added that koalas will go extinct if new laws are not passed to protect forests. The Australian Koala Foundation estimates that there are less than 100,000 koalas left in the wild. There may be as few as 43,000. Summer forest fires in 2019 and 2020 killed at least 6,400 of the animals. Rescue workers tried hard to save them and treat their injuries. There have been many pressures on the koala. The black summer fires, of course, was a tipping point. But we know the koala is vulnerable to climate change and to disease, Lee told reporters Friday. Lee said the government is working to protect the animal. She said vaccines are being given to koalas to prevent and treat chlamydia, and drones are being used to study them and rebuild their habitat. The government says that listing koalas as endangered will bring attention to them and help address threats. But conservation groups argue more has to be done to prevent their extinction. The Australian Koala Foundation has called for legislation to protect them and prevent land clearing and mining projects that are destroying their habitats. It says koalas are also in danger across Victoria and South Australia. Changing their status to endangered does not really help, said Deborah Tabbert. She is the head of the foundation. Behind all the photo opportunities and political rhetoric, they, the federal government, continue to approve the destruction of koala habitat, she said. I'm Dan Novak.
Talk to the best cooks in Italy, and you might learn a simple secret to making great pasta. Save the water the noodles are cooked in. After pasta noodles have finished cooking, Italian cooks do not throw out all the water. They keep a small amount to use when making the sauce for the dish. The leftover water contains starch from the pasta. This starch helps other ingredients stick to the noodles. It also helps to thicken the sauce. And because the water often has salt, and sometimes other seasonings, it adds flavor too. Food expert Christopher Kimball recently wrote about the secret of making pasta for the Associated Press. He said he and his team at Milk Street thought of this method while developing recipes for a one-pot pasta. With this one-pot recipe, you not only get a rich and thick sauce, you also have less cleanup. The starch released by the pasta gives the sauce thickness, and the pasta takes in more of the sauce's flavors. Remember these terms. A recipe is the list of steps needed to make a dish, and ingredients are the individual food items in a recipe. This recipe uses only 6 main ingredients, plus spices and herbs. The recipe appears in Milk Street's book, Cookish. The main ingredients are cherry tomatoes, onion, Italian dry salami, fontina cheese, and of course, pasta. Salami is a salty, dry meat. For people who do not eat meat, you could use mushrooms instead. Kimball cuts the salami into small cubes. This lets them cook evenly in the pot. He also cuts the fontina cheese into small cubes and adds them at the end. The cheese makes the dish rich. Any other cheese that melts easily can also be used. The dish, Kimball says, is a tasty meal that takes less than 30 minutes to make. It uses just one pot, so cleanup is also quick. One-pot pasta with tomatoes, salami, and fontina. From start to finish, this dish takes about 25 minutes to make. It serves 4 to 6 people. Here are the ingredients. All measurements are approximate. 12.5 grams extra virgin olive oil. 113 grams salami cut into small cubes. 1 liter cherry or grape tomatoes. 1 medium onion cut into small pieces. 5 grams fennel seeds. Kosher salt and ground pepper. To taste. 454 grams of pasta, 112 grams fontina cheese, or some other cheese that melts, cut into small cubes. In a large pot, heat the oil. Add the salami and cook until it turns brown. Add the tomatoes, onion, fennel seeds, and a small amount of black pepper. Cook until most of the tomatoes have opened. Add about a liter of water, salt, and bring to a boil. Stir in the uncooked pasta. Cover and cook, mixing around every few minutes. Make sure the water continues boiling. When the pasta is still a bit firm, pour out the water and save a cupful. Move the pot off the heated surface. Mix in the fontina cheese, then season with salt and pepper. Add some of the pasta water as needed to thicken the sauce. If you like, you can add freshly cut parsley or cilantro on top. This is just one pasta recipe, but you can use the pasta water with just about any pasta dish and any sauce. I'm Jill Robbins.
COVID-19 vaccines are saving lives, but they cannot stop new versions of coronavirus from appearing. This has led scientists to ask the following questions. Are more shots needed? Should changes be made to existing shots? Or should new vaccines be developed? Dr. Daniel Karitskis is infectious disease chief at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He told the Associated Press, "We need collectively to be rethinking what is the goal of vaccination." Karitskis said, "It's unrealistic to believe that any kind of vaccination is going to protect people from infection, from mild symptomatic disease, forever." If the goal is preventing serious illness, he added, we may not need to be doing as much fine-tuning of the vaccines every time a new variant comes. As the virus changes or mutates, there is no way to know how bad the next variant will be. Already a substrain of Omicron with its mutations is spreading. Jennifer Nuzzo of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security suggested the immediate solution is getting today's shots into more arms. This step, she said, will reduce the opportunities for the virus to mutate.
The job of blocking infection falls to antibodies, which form after either vaccination or getting COVID-19. The antibodies are ready to fight back the next time a person is exposed. But there is a problem. Mutations change the appearance of the spike protein that covers the coronavirus. That is why Omicron was able to break through that first defense. Also, the immune system is not designed to always be on high alert, so the antibodies that fight off infection decrease over time. Thankfully, a part of the immune system called T cells helps prevent an infection from turning into severe illness. The protection T cells offer lasts longer because T cells recognize other parts of the virus that do not mutate as easily.
In some countries, people are getting a third shot, and in some cases, a fourth shot, to fight against decreased immunity and new variants. These shots are sometimes called boosters. The booster further strengthened protection against serious illness, but research has shown that protection against symptomatic disease from Omicron is only about 70%, not as high as 94% against earlier variants. Dr. Paul Offit is a vaccine expert at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He said that endless boosting just to keep antibody levels high is not a public health strategy that works.
Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna have two of the most effective vaccines against the coronavirus. The drug companies say they are now testing Omicron-specific boosters in some American adults. However, it is not clear if health officials would drop vaccines proven to save lives for new ones in hopes of reducing breakthrough infections. Drug makers can combine two different kinds of shots, but they would have to prove that the mixture works well against the virus. In the United States, the National Institutes of Health is spending about $43 million to develop so-called pan-coronavirus vaccines. The hope is to have one vaccine that can protect against more than one kind of coronavirus. Pan means all. One idea is to have the shot send spike proteins from 4 to 8 different versions of the virus, rather than one as in today's vaccines. But NIH Infectious Diseases Chief Dr. Anthony Fauci said it will take some time to develop such a vaccine. Another idea is to create COVID-19 vaccines that can be squirted into the nose. The nasal vaccine can form antibodies ready to fight the virus right where it enters the body. This kind of vaccine is harder to develop than injected vaccines, but several companies, including India's Bharat Biotech, have started research.
The difficulty with any possible change to the vaccination strategy is that only 10% of people in some countries have received at least one shot of vaccines. Additionally, some approved vaccines do not provide as much protection against Omicron as those from Pfizer and Moderna. For example, Yale University researchers found no Omicron-targeted antibodies in the blood of people given two shots of China's Sinovac. It means that any change in vaccination strategy must be dealt with locally. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1920s are remembered as a quiet period in American foreign policy. The nation was at peace. Americans elected three Republican presidents in a row: Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. These conservatives in the White House were generally more interested in economic growth at home than in relations with other countries. But the United States had become a world power. It was tied to other countries by trade, politics, and shared interests. And America had gained new economic strength. Bob Doty and Shirley Griffith discuss American foreign policy during the 1920s.
Before World War I, foreigners invested more money in the United States than Americans invested in other countries, about $3 billion more. The war changed this. By 1919, Americans had almost $3 billion more invested in other countries than foreign citizens had invested in the United States. American foreign investments continued to increase greatly during the 1920s. Increased foreign investment was not the only sign of growing American economic power. By the end of World War I, the United States produced more goods and services than any other nation, both in total and per person. Americans had more steel, food, cloth, and coal than even the richest foreign nations. By 1920, the United States' national income was greater than the combined incomes of Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Canada, and 17 smaller countries. Quite simply, the United States had become the world's greatest economic power.
America's economic strength influenced its policies toward Europe during the 1920s. In fact, one of the most important issues of this period was the economic aid the United States had provided European nations during World War I. Americans lent the Allied countries $7 billion during the war. Shortly after the war, they lent another $3 billion. The Allies borrowed most of the money for military equipment and food and other needs of their people. The Allied nations suffered far greater losses of property and population than the United States during the war. And when peace came, they called on the United States to cancel the loans America had made. France, Britain, and the other Allied nations said the United States should not expect them to repay the loans.
The United States refused to cancel the debts. President Coolidge spoke for most Americans when he said simply, "They borrowed the money." He believed the European powers should pay back the war loans, even though their economies had suffered terribly during the fighting. However, the European nations had little money to pay their loans. France tried to get the money by demanding payments from Germany for having started the war. When Germany was unable to pay, France and Belgium occupied Germany's Ruhr Valley. As a result, German miners in the area reduced coal production. And France and Germany moved toward an economic crisis and possible new armed conflict.
An international group intervened and negotiated a settlement to the crisis. The group provided a system to save Germany's currency and protect international debts. American bankers agreed to lend money to Germany to pay its war debts to the Allies. And the Allies used the money to pay their debts to the United States.
Some Americans with international interests criticized President Coolidge and other conservative leaders for not reducing or canceling Europe's debts. They said the debts and the new payment plan put foolish pressure on the weak European economies. They said this made the German currency especially weak, and they warned that a weak economy would lead to serious social problems in Germany and other countries. However, most Americans did not understand the serious effect that international economic policies could have on the future of world peace. They believed that it was wrong for the Europeans, or anyone, to borrow money and then refuse to pay it back.
Many Americans of the 1920s also failed to recognize that a strong national military force would become increasingly important in the coming years. President Coolidge requested very limited military spending from the Congress. And many conservative military leaders refused to spend much money on such new kinds of equipment as submarines and airplanes. Some Americans did understand that the United States was now a world power and needed a strong and modern fighting force. One general, Billy Mitchell, publicly criticized the military leadership for not building new weapons. But most Americans were not interested. Many Americans continued to oppose arms spending until the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii in 1941.
American policy toward the League of Nations did not change much in the 1920s. In 1919, the Senate denied President Wilson's plea for the United States to join the new League of Nations. The United States, however, became involved unofficially in a number of League activities, but it continued to refuse to become a full member. And in 1930, the Senate rejected a proposal for the United States to join the World Court. The United States also continued in the 1920s to refuse to recognize the communist government in Moscow. However, trade between the Soviet Union and the United States increased greatly during this period. And such large American companies as General Electric, DuPont, and RCA provided technical assistance to the new Soviet government.
The Coolidge administration was involved actively in events in Latin America. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes helped several Latin American countries to settle border disputes peacefully. In Central America, President Coolidge ordered American Marines into Nicaragua when President Adolfo Diaz faced a revolt from opposition groups. The United States gave its support to more conservative groups in Nicaragua, and it helped arrange a national election in 1928. American troops stayed in Nicaragua until 1933. However, American troops withdrew from the Dominican Republic during this period. And Secretary of State Hughes worked to give new life to the Pan-American Union.
Relations with Mexico became worse during the 1920s. In 1925, Mexican President Plutarco Elias Calles called for laws to give Mexico more control over its minerals and natural wealth. American oil companies resisted the proposed changes. They accused Calles of communism, and some American business and church leaders called for armed American intervention. However, the American Senate voted to try to settle the conflict peacefully, and American diplomat Dwight Morrow helped negotiate a successful new agreement.
These American actions in Nicaragua and Mexico showed that the United States still felt that it had special security interests south of its border. But its peaceful settlement of the Mexican crisis and support of elections in Nicaragua showed that it was willing to deal with disputes peacefully. America's policies in Latin America during the 1920s were in some ways similar to its policies elsewhere. It was a time of change, of movement, from one period to another. Many Americans were hoping to follow the traditional foreign policies of the past. They sought to remain separate from world conflict.
The United States, however, could no longer remain apart from world events. This would become clear in the coming years. Europe would face fascism and war. The Soviet Union would grow more powerful. And Latin America would become more independent. The United States was a world power, but it was still learning in the 1920s about the leadership and responsibility that is part of such power.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.